Thank you for listening to this presentation from Real Life Ministries. We are excited to share the proclamation of the gospel, and we hope wherever you are listening today that it will be an inspiration to you and challenge you to grow closer to Jesus. We would like to hear your story. Email us at info@reallifeministries.com. Also, we invite you to give to this ministry online at reallifeministries.com/giving. Again, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, it's an honor to be here, and as we get going, I want to start out with a question, and that is, how many of you feel like our culture is going to hell in a handbasket at warp speed? Okay, just kind of wondered. And now, obviously, kind of what happens in our culture speeds up, slows down based on all kinds of events that happen, from political to judgeships to whatever. But to be quite candid with you, the die has already been cast. History is quite clear that when the bastions of higher education and the arts and what we today call the media, but the sources of major communication, once they've locked into a set of values, it's inevitable that the rest of the culture gets pulled along, sometimes quickly, sometimes more slowly. And that's exactly why we're going to be looking at the passage we're going to look at today. It's a passage that if you've had the privilege of growing up in a Christian home, you never probably saw as applying to this particular issue. Because if you're like me, where I grew up not only in a Christian home, but I got to go to Sunday school, when it came to this book called Daniel, I thought of it as the ultimate adventure story, right? I mean, it's a Sunday school teacher's dream. It's got three dudes that refuse to bow down before an idol and get thrown into a fiery furnace, and they come out, and in the day and age of videos, way back in the day and age of flanographs, whatever it is, you can make that exciting. Okay, and then you've got some guy who won't stop praying, so they throw him to hungry lions, and the hungry lions suddenly decide they want to go on a fast, and it's just got amazing stuff. So most people tend to think of this book of Daniel as an adventure story for kids. And then as I got a little older, I began to realize there were some adults who thought of it as a prophecy primer, because it's got a few prophetic passages at the end, and so they would turn to those and figure out everything about Jesus' return, his timetable, all the details, and all that. Of course, they've all been wrong for 2,000 years, but somebody's going to get it. But those were the two primary things I thought Daniel was, and it never dawned on me until I was early in my ministry working on teaching through the book of Daniel, that this is not an adventure story, that as a little kid, I thought, taught this lesson, that if you're faithful to God and if you're courageous and you stand up and don't give in, nothing can touch you, right? Thrown to a lion's den, you live. Thrown into fires, you live. But if that's the main lesson of the book of Daniel, then God has some major explaining to do. Because everybody else thrown to hungry lions became lunch. And everybody else thrown into a fiery furnace became toast. The lesson isn't if we're courageous, nothing can touch us. The primary lesson of the book of Daniel that we're going to look at today is that it is an adult book addressed to adults, telling us how to survive and actually thrive in the most godless of environments. That's the purpose of Daniel. There were no Sunday schools. There were no prophecy manuals and conferences. It was written to tell us how to live in an increasingly godless culture. And today I want you to put those lenses on as we look through this passage, and I want to encourage you to read through it later this week as well in preparation for the coming messages that your team's going to be bringing you. And as you do that, just keep asking yourself, what does this teach me? What does this teach me? What does this teach me about living in a modern-day Babylon? Okay? So, if you're not already there, I want to invite you to take your Bibles and find Daniel chapter 1. Daniel's in what's called the Old Testament. If you're brand new at following Jesus in the Bible, God put a table of contents in the front of your Bible. And so you'll be able to find it. And if you got a digital device, just use the search function, you know? But find Daniel chapter 1. And what we're going to do is I'm going to kind of do a running commentary, I like to call it, where I'm just going to read the verses, stop along the way, point out some stuff. And then we're done with that. We're going to step back and we're going to pretend that we're at your favorite coffee place. And you've asked me, yeah, but how does this work out in real life? And we'll apply the application of it to where we live. Okay? So here we go, Daniel chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. And the, talk to me, and the what? Lord. You, if you treat your Bible as a life textbook, and I sure hope you do, you ought to underline that phrase. It is incredibly important. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. And these he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylon and put in the treasure house of his God. Now, when you see Daniel's adventure story, like I always saw, these first two verses, just get over them. When it's a prophecy primer, let's get into the future. But Daniel, what we've got here is an autobiography. It's not a diary contemporaneous. It's at the end of his life. He's looking back and he's writing his story. He's going to leave a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. He's going to take other things and say, this is incredibly important. But as he starts, he does what every author does. He says, this is the foundation you need to know. And I actually believe these first two verses in Daniel are the most important verses in the entire book. They're the key that unlocks it. And Daniel says, before you know what I did, before you know what shaped my attitudes and my responses, you need to understand this, that even as a young 16 to 18-year-old boy kidnapped and taken off to Babylon, as I was being marched there, I understood this. And every behavior was based on it. God's in control of who's in control. And that is not just a foundation. That is a cornerstone of the foundation of everything Daniel thought and everything Daniel did. Now, I want us to grasp it from kind of the way a Jewish person would have read those verses, because we just kind of read them, little history, yeah, whatever. No, Jerusalem was located on God's holy hill. His temple was the place of his perceived presence. The idea that damnable, godless Nebuchadnezzar would be allowed to conquer Jerusalem blew their minds before it happened. And God was saying, listen, I told you this would happen if you don't follow me. I'm going to turn you over to the godless nations around you if you don't want me as your king. But when it happened, they just thought like, well, that can't happen. And so Daniel's quite clear, not only that Nebuchadnezzar besieged it, but the Lord said, here it is. And then there's something else in this passage. He says he took devoted things and brought them to the temple of his demon god Baal and put them in that temple as a tribute to Baal and a mocking of the true God. Now, to an Israelite, this was unfathomable because they all knew the story of how precious the things devoted to God were and that you don't mess with God's stuff. You see, the story of when they moved in their promised land began with the first battle, a battle against a town called Jericho, and the Lord had instituted a principle that applies to this day, which is called the first fruits principle. The first of what God blesses us with belongs to him. And then after that, it's ours. And so he said, when you move into your promised land, when you tackle this city called Jericho, all of the spoils, every single thing, is to be taken and put into the treasury temple, the temple treasury, for when a temple is built. Well, they did exactly what they were told to do, except for one bozo named Achan. He decided, it's just a couple of these things are really cool. I don't think they're going to be missed. And he hid them under the tent, his tent. Well, the next town they went against was just a little podunk place. It's called Ai. In the Hebrew, it's Coeur d'Alene. And so they decided they would not send their whole army there. They just send a smaller group. And they sent them, and they were thoroughly routed. Over 30 Jewish soldiers were killed. Sons did not come home. Dads did not come home. Husbands did not come home. Not because they didn't pray enough, not because they had a bad battle plan, not because they presumed upon victory, but because this one guy had hidden just a couple of devoted things to God under his tent. And until that was solved, they were not going to be able to take any more land. In fact, they were going to be routed. So here they read, you mean the Lord delivered Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar and he took his stuff from the temple and said, you take whatever you want and you put it in your demon god's temple and you go ahead and mock me? And it was God who was behind it. Now, Daniel didn't understand why. I'm sure Daniel didn't like it. All kinds of things going on. But Daniel said, man, the foundation of my behavior, my thoughts, is that God's in control of who's in control. And then we suddenly jump way forward to the next part of his story. And it takes place in verse 3. The king ordered Asphanaz, chief of the court officials. And in the original Hebrew language, it's actually the chief eunuch. Just clock that for later. To bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility. And I love the humble way Daniel describes he and his friends. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing attitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace, if I say so myself. And he was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. Now, if your margin, you might write this little note. The literature and the language of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians is code for astrology and the occult. We're going to see for 3 years he had to get a master's degree in astrology and the occult. And the end of that, he was supposed to join the administration of damnable, godless, demon-worshipping Nebuchadnezzar, who had destroyed his temple and had destroyed his city. The king assigned them a daily amount of food from the king's table, and they were trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter into the king's service. Among those who were chosen from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the chief eunuch or official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. Azariah, Abednego. Or as my kids learned the story at home, Shadrach, Meshach, to bed we go. But that's another thing. But here's what I want you to note. Daniel had his name changed, and Daniel means God is my judge. His name was changed to Belshazzar, which means Baal's prince. So his name was changed from one that honored the true God to being the prince of a demon god. Well, Daniel, we're told in the next verse, resolved not to defile himself with royal food and wine. And he asked, underline that, the chief eunuch or official, for permission, underline that, not to defile himself this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, listen, you do not understand how bloodthirsty this place is. I'm afraid of my lord the king who has assigned you food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? He's going to have my head because of you. Now, one thing we know about Daniel is he didn't know much about the Bible or God's law. How do I know that? Because the only reason that Jerusalem was turned over to a godless nation was that God had predicted this would happen if they refused to follow him and obey him. So it was a time of great spiritual darkness, so great God said, you want me as king? You get this dude. Well, if that is going on, we know Daniel doesn't know much because Daniel's not having daily devotions and reading his Bible because Gutenberg hasn't come along yet, okay? He only knows what he's been taught. And there were three primary things that even in the darkest of times, all the Israelites knew. You don't worship an idol. On the eighth day, a boy is to be circumcised. And you have a kosher diet. So the king's diet wasn't kosher. And what I want you to catch here that you'll see all throughout Daniel, I encourage you to read it this next week in prep for the other sermons. And what you're going to see is that Daniel was always incredibly respectful. He asked for permission. He didn't say, hey, man, you have no idea. I'm a Jew. We don't eat this junk. Let me tell you. No, he didn't cop an attitude. He didn't have any of this stuff. And that's why the Lord was able to cause him to have great favor in the guy that was over him because he was so cotton picking, respectful. He just asked, you know, is there any way, please, can I have permission not to do this? He didn't draw the line. He didn't pick a fight. Well, when he was told no, now look at verse 11. So Daniel had a conniption fit. I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong Bible here. It's what a lot of guys and gals I know today would do as Jesus followers. No, he just said to the guard whom the chief eunuch official appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for just 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then compare our appearance to that of the young men who eat the royal food, and then treat your servants in accordance with whatever you see. Please test us, and we will accept whatever the consequences are. Well, that's an offer too good to refuse. So the guy said, well, sure, I can do that. And then at the end of 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. Little sidebar just for fun for some of you. You know how we have Jesus junk, you know, those little coffee mugs and all that with all the stuff we put, little verses and all that. This one should be on more of them. It should be some of your favorite verses. Because the passage actually says this. It says he was healthier and better nourished. Literally, the Hebrew says he was fatter. Favorite verse for some of us. See, that was a good thing. You see, we live in a day and age where everybody wants to starve themselves and, you know, work out and all that kind of stuff. And back then, you know who the skinny people were? They were the poor people. Okay, so when Daniel did his real Daniel diet, what he did is he didn't get a six pack, he got 6 pounds. So now I just gave some of you your life verse. Just thought I'd encourage you. It's on all my Jesus junk at home. Okay, so the guard took away their choice food and he gave them vegetables instead. And now we pick it up, the rest of the story, verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. In other words, God allowed them to graduate at the top of their class 3 years of studying astrology and the occult. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kind. And at the end of the time set up by the king to bring them into the service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered into the king's service. They entered Nebuchadnezzar's administration. And by the way, they kept serving so well and so respectfully, they kept getting promoted to higher and higher positions. You don't get promoted if you serve poorly or you cop an attitude. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the previous valedictorians, the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the third year of the king Cyrus. Now, I want to step back and do a little bit of what I did when I talked about the devoted things. I want us to really grasp how evil Babylon was and to grasp how deep the weeds Daniel personally found himself caught in were. So let's step back and let's talk about how bad it was. First of all, the nation. Did you know if you could suddenly be transported to heaven and be in the presence of a dialogue of the heavenly angels and they were discussing wickedness upon earth, that their word picture, their short little image, their personification of evil would be Babylon? How do I know this? Well, because in the book of Revelation, we're told that right before Jesus returns, when the angels realize he's gonna come, they cry out, some of you might know, help me out, fallen, fallen is Babylon. And Babylon was destroyed and a prophecy was given it would never be rebuilt. So when Jesus returns, it's not like there's gonna be a real Babylon, but among the angels, when they think of what represents all evil, it's not fallen, fallen is the Nazi Germany, fallen, fallen is ISIS, fallen, fallen is Sodom and Gomorrah. No, the most evil nation ever in the eyes of the angelic beings is Babylon. That's how bad it was. How bad was their king? Man, we've had some bad rulers and governors and senators and reps and presidents and all kinds of things throughout our history, good, bad, and ugly. But we've never had one so bad that he stole God's stuff, worshiped a demon god, and mocked God publicly and consistently. That's Nebuchadnezzar. And the culture? Oh my gosh. The culture was incredibly bad as well. I'm from California, the land of fruits and nuts. And hey, I ain't staying, I'm going back home. And I got to tell you, many of you are from there. It's a strange, I mean, I go to bed sometimes, wake up the next morning, read the news and go, what? From a governor to a legislature to a judge or what, like, what are they smoking? I know what they're smoking, but that's another issue. Now, on top of that, our educational system at times can be bizarro. And now every family has to choose, you know, whether you want to go from homeschool to a Christian school to a public school. And God will, if you seek the Lord, he'll tell each and every family what to do. In our case, because my kids were growing up in a pastor's home, and on top of that, we had a larger church with great children's and youth programs. I did not want them to be 27 before they met a non-Christian. So we decided to put them in the public school system when they hit about junior high. What happened along the way is they got a really good education, a lot of things, but there were some pretty bizarre things that happened. There were things said in classrooms and little movie parts and things that were shown that we had to have discussions about. Now, I never went to the teacher, the principal, or whatever, because I would have clearly taught my kids, never tell dad again what happened at school today. But we dealt with it. I just didn't want them inoculated, and there were really good things and really bad things for us. But I want to tell you, in the worst school, in the worst school district, with the worst teacher and the worst classroom, no one has ever come to the point where you have to have a 3-year graduate course in astrology and the occult to get a job. You know, I hear people complain and shake their head. I go, you don't even know what bad is. They're not even close to that. That's where Daniel was. Now, how difficult was his personal situation on top of that? Well, it was pretty bad. He was kidnapped, castrated, and had his name changed to honor Satan. I don't know about you, but to me, that's a really bad week. On top of that, he was forced to study the occult, serve in the administration of an evil and godless king. Now, I know some of you who've been Sunday school teachers before and been in Sunday school, if you've been in Sunday school, you go, they never taught me about that castration thing. Well, we don't teach our third graders either. But if you've been teaching, you go, I've read Daniel. Where is that? Well, it's not explicit, but it's implied. Let me explain something to you. Back in that day and age, kings like Nebuchadnezzar, the Assyrians, and others, when they would capture city-states or places, they would take all of the beautiful young women and they would bring them back and put them in their, what? Their harem. And they would also take, as Daniel describes himself, the handsome, witty, really cool guys back, and they would train them and put them in their administration. Now, you help me. You guys see a problem there? You're a crusty old king, and you have a harem full of hot chicks over here, and you have a whole bunch of handsome young dudes over here. Do you see a problem? Do you see how they might solve it? That's why I kept pointing out the chief eunuch, the chief eunuch, the chief eunuch. You see, in biblical times, not only in Israel, but in all of those nations, it was very important to have a family and to have sons. The Israelites added the Abrahamic promise and covenant they wanted to pass on, but there was also the very real sense of, in your old age, your sons were your social security. You could get a dowry out of a daughter, but you got protection out of your sons. And so if you never had sons, it was a great, great curse. And that's why throughout the Bible, you'll hear these stories or whatever, and then they'll just kind of throw in, and by the way, so-and-so begat so-and-so. Because it was so much more important in that culture than it is to us today. And you read through the book of Daniel, and you know he was put in the administration and all that. There's not a word about family for very obvious reasons. And so that's why I say Daniel had every reason to be rather bitter at Babylon, at Nebuchadnezzar, and at God. But he wasn't. And he understood the keys to not just surviving in this bizarre, unchosen situation, but to thrive and make an impact for the glory of God. And I want to share with you what those three keys are. I'm going to spend most of the time on the first one and then just quickly the other two because you'll touch those in other messages. But the three keys to Daniel's success were simply this. Number one, Daniel was a man of hope and optimism. Daniel was a man of hope and optimism. He wants us to understand from the get-go as a young man kidnapped and taken somewhere, castrated, then forced to study and forced to serve the king. From the beginning of his forced march, he understood this, that God's in control of who's in control. And because of that, everything changed about his attitude and about his actions. Because you see, panic and despair are never from God. Now, there's a time and a place to be discouraged. Jesus found himself up against a situation and assignment he didn't want. Three times he prayed it'd be taken away. He sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. He was so angst over what was coming up. The Apostle Paul talks about being depressed. And what solves his depression is not a Bible verse or a spiritual insight. The thing he was depressed about suddenly is fixed. So he says, oh, God fixed it. Thank you. So, you know, emotions, ups and downs, fine. But to live in despair is, to be a despairing Christian is an oxymoron. And when it happens, it undercuts our ability to have influence upon those that we rub shoulders with. You know, see, nobody ever who's a non-Christian you work with or your neighbor or whatever, and you have the privilege of being with these folks, they're never going to want to go, can I join your losing team? Right? Have you ever done that? Yeah, you guys look like you are just getting crushed. Can I join you? No. You see, Daniel understood that God's in control. It will work out. And knowing that, who cares what the score is in the third quarter if you know you're going to win in the end? You know, at North Coast, what happens all the time, people are asking me and the other teaching pastor, Chris Brown, not that Chris Brown, a different one, will you guys teach the book of Revelation? And I usually say, well, first of all, they don't want us to teach Revelation. They just want us to tell them who the Antichrist is, as if I know. So I tell them, sorry, I resigned my position on the programming committee a while ago. I'm just on the welcoming committee now. So I'm probably not going to be able to answer all your questions. But I have read the book numerous times. And like the first time even, I cheated. I looked at the end. We win. And if I know we win in the end, who cares what the score is in the third quarter? See, Daniel knew that God had promised he'd restore them, and part of the end of Daniel talks about that and bring them back, and that's why he was able to behave as he behaved. I think some of the angst that we sometimes feel that therefore fuels the wrong responses that we have is because we theologically believe we win, but we don't really believe we win. Now, I'm going to give you an illustration. Before I do that, you got to promise me grace, because some of you are going to like this illustration, some of you not. So do y'all promise me grace? You're in church, you have to give it to me. Y'all promise? Okay. It's a disease I got from my dad. It's all his fault, so don't blame me, but still give me grace. From a little kid on, he taught me to be a USC football fan. Okay? I know, University of Spoiled Children and cheaters. I've heard it all. Still my team, so get over it. But a number of years ago, USC was on this incredible run. It looked like they were on their way to the third national championship. And if you're a USC fan, most people on the outside think your number one rival is UCLA. And it's a rival, but not number one at all. The number one rival for a USC football fan is Notre Dame. Two storied programs, not a lot of trash talk and incredible respect, cross-country rivalry, lots of national championships, Heisman Trophy winners. That's the game you don't want to lose. Well, that year, SC plays at Notre Dame. And Notre Dame at that point is undefeated, but they hadn't really played anybody and they weren't rated that highly. And SC's on its way to seemingly a national championship, so you just don't want to lose to them. SC had a speed team that year, very fast players. And I am not exaggerating. What Notre Dame did is they grew the grass this high. Okay, for real. You watch the game and you can't see the guy's feet. Now, if you're a fast runner, grass like this changes things. So they tried to, you know, neutralize the field. Now, if you're a sports fan, you know this principle, that if you let a weaker team get up off the mat numerous times instead of crushing them when you have the chance, you're going to rue the day. And I'm watching the game at home alone, and that's exactly what happens. SC squanders opportunity after opportunity, and sure enough, with 2 minutes left in the game, Notre Dame marches all the way down the field and scores a go-ahead touchdown. Well, I'm thinking maybe God will turn his attention from the other stuff and, you know, take care of this. So we'll run the, you know, no time left, but we'll run the kickoff back or some miracle, or it didn't happen. the seconds are ticking off, and SC now is on second down at, I think, about the 80 yards away from a touchdown. The quarterback fades back for a pass. Nobody's open. A Notre Dame guy breaks through and throws him for a 13-yard loss. The crowd goes nuts. High-fiving, hugging, all of this stuff. The players are chest bumping, stupid leprechauns going across the field. It was horrific. The announcers are all saying, it's the end of it, and, all the crowd shots, and because there's just no way. With the thick grass, time running out, the crazy stadium momentum, it's over. They try another play, goes nowhere. Now it's fourth and a gazillion yards, so stinking noisy and loud you can't hear anything. The SC quarterback fades back, throws a desperation pass. It just gets over the fingertips of the defender, nestles into the hands of a USC receiver who races all the way down the sideline and is knocked out of bounds a couple yards short of a touchdown. And then on the final play of the game, order is restored in the universe. A play called the Bush Push happens, and SC wins. Now I want to tell you, as I was watching that game, when the play happened where the quarterback was sacked and now it's fourth and a gazillion yards and all that, I lost my sanctification. I uttered all kinds of pastoral Christian euphemisms. I was ready to throw something at the TV, then I went, whoops, new big screen. Kick the dog, do something. Well, I have a DVD of that game, and I watch it every 3 or 4 days, and I've watched it a few times, and here's what's weird, is when I get to that play where the quarterback is sacked and all is lost, you know what I do? I play it again in slow motion. I watch all those fans hug each other. I freeze frame the chest bump. I watch that cute little leprechaun go across the field. And then I play it again. Now, it's the same stinking play. It's the exact same thing. There's only one thing different. What is it? I know what happens next. Men and women, if we really are followers of Jesus, we can never forget what happens next. And when we forget what happens next, we behave as if all is lost. And that's never to the glory of God. When we know how it ends, we can respond appropriately, just like Daniel did. And that leads just real quickly to the last two things about him, that we're all built upon this huge principle I've shared with you. And the second key was not just his hope and optimism, because he knew how it was going to end, but it was his humility. And his humility, next to that, you might write the word respect, because humility, to us, humility is like a low view of yourself. You're the fastest sixth grader, and somebody says, are you fast? And you're supposed to say, no, dude, you're fast. Humility is treating others as better than you, even if they aren't. It's what Jesus did when he washed feet and said, now, why don't you do this for one another? And so what Daniel did, you'll find throughout his whole book, Daniel and his buddies and everywhere, there's not one case where they cop an attitude. There's not one case where they look down on people. Every single response to his personal enemies and God's enemies and the destroyers of God's stuff was incredibly respectful. And as I said earlier, he served Nebuchadnezzar so well, he kept getting promoted until he was finally in a position to speak the truth to Nebuchadnezzar. By the way, there was also a time where Nebuchadnezzar got his arrogance and his boastfulness said, look what I have built with my power and my strength. And so God said, dude, that's it. I've used you kind of as a little switch on the Israelites and all that, but I'm tired of you. You're done. And guess who gets to deliver the message? Daniel. Now, if I'm Daniel, I've risen up in the administration, here's how I do it. Neb, baby, I've been praying for this for a long time. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what Daniel said. O king, I wish it was anybody but you. That's why he led three revivals. You see, I'm sure you're just like me. I've never been influenced, listened to, changed by somebody who looked down on me, didn't like me, or showed disrespect. Ever. All I became was defensive. And he was able to do that because he knew God's in control and how it ends. So I'll just play my part. Even though I don't understand everything or like everything, I'll play my part. Now, the third thing about him was not only his hope and not only his humility shown in respect, but his wisdom to pick his battles carefully. His wisdom to pick his battles carefully. I'm always amazed at what Daniel drew the line in the sand over and what he ignored. His buddies wouldn't bow down to an idol. He wouldn't stop praying and he wouldn't eat a kosher diet. But there's all kinds of other things. It's like, whatever. I mean, you want to change my name to say demon god's, prince? It's like, cool. Just not late to dinner. I'm good. You want me to study astrology and the cult? I'm not going to sit in the back and make paper airplanes and roll my eyes. I'm going to sit in the front, take copious notes, graduate number one in my class, so I have the right and the authority later on to point out, I do know this stuff, and I want to tell you it's a bunch of junk, and let me tell you about the real God, which is what he did. See? He didn't fight that. He didn't fight serving Nebuchadnezzar's administration. He didn't say, get me coffee, spit in the coffee and give it to him. No, he served him so well, he kept getting promoted, and he kept getting more and more influence for the glory of God. If we want to influence, not just survive under a cave somewhere, but influence and thrive, we have to have hope. We have to have humility that people feel like they're experiencing. And we need wisdom to so much more carefully pick our battles. Because there's a big difference between what God forbids and I don't like. God forbids bowing down before an idol. God forbids the kosher diet. But God doesn't ever have a verse that says, this is your name. There's not a verse that says non-Christians are supposed to live like Christians, right? If I clean up all the lives of all the non-Christians I know who are, many non-Christians live a very, very moral life, but those who are on the edge of even advancing the enemy's agenda, if I clean up their life, all I'm doing is populating hell with nicer people. People need to know Jesus. And he takes wretched people like you and me, and he turns us into sons and daughters of the king. That's what the message is. That's what Daniel got. And I want to tell you, you have so much more impact than you realize. I want to tie this all together with a story that, and a huge lesson I learned. How many of you have been to Carlsbad Caverns? Help me out. Okay, good number of you. We went there on a family vacation. And to understand this story, the first thing you need to know is my wife is claustrophobic. Now, she's not crazy claustrophobic, but you can see crazy from where she is, but that's another issue. So we're just assuming she's going to stay up in the visitor center up on top. But if you've been there, it's really big. They have a huge elevator. They got pictures of the big caverns. So she actually says, I'll go down with you. So we go down. The elevator door opens, a huge, massive cavern, and she goes, rah. I think I'll go on the tour with you guys. And I'm like, thank you, Jesus. Family memory. So we're all waiting in line for our tickets, and things are going great until two guys come out, and one says to the other one, that was so cool when they turned the lights out. Now, I'm in a moral dilemma. Do I say something or whatever? I decided not to. But she heard him, and she goes, they turned the lights out? I go, hon, it's just for a couple seconds. Are you sure? Trust me, I'm a pastor. So we go on the tour, everything is great, and if you've been on it, the last thing they do, they set you in these little logs, and they take the plug and unplug it to show you how pitch dark it is. 1001, 1002, 1010. And then a bat bit me. I could feel it, and then the blood, and then the bat spoke. It said, I will never trust you again. which in my profession is a really bad thing. And then I remembered, my oldest son, Nathan, had a brand new Indiglow, Timex Indiglow watch. You know, the ones where you push the button and a little light went on? Well, I want to tell you how lame that light was. When he first got it, at night in his bedroom, he pushed the light, and the only way he could see what time it was by getting a flashlight. It was the lamest thing you've ever seen. But I said, Nathan, push the button. He pushed the button, and suddenly you could see the ground. You could see our feet. Somebody over here goes, turn that light out. I said, I'll kill you if you do. The bat let go. My marriage was saved. And I learned this incredible lesson. The darker it gets, the more powerful the tiniest of lights becomes. Amen. Throw away the angst. Grab hold of the hope. Treat people with incredible respect, no matter who they are or what they do. Have the wisdom to pick your battles. In other words, push the right buttons on your little tiny lame watch, and it can lead people out of the cave. Father, take the things that we have seen, bind them on our hearts that we might bring honor and glory to you and fame to your name. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Bless you.
We thank you for spending some time with us, wherever you might be, and we hope that you were blessed by the message today. For more information about Real Life Ministries, visit us on the web at reallifeministries.com. And we also invite you to give through this website by clicking on the giving link.